we're not currently building tools that align with our values beyond sort of the basest ones, things like efficiency and cost savings. We can do better than that. We're building systems that don't have the kind of gears they need to really ride through the hills and valleys of inequality that actually exist in this country. And if we continue to build systems in neutral, we should not be surprised when rather than solving bias problems, they amplify or intensify inequality.
This time on 20 Minutes into the Future, John Lubkowski and Scoop Sweeney speak with author and educator Virginia Eubanks about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor.
On this episode of our Plutopia podcast, we'll be talking to Virginia Eubanks, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Albany at the State University of New York. We'll be discussing her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. The book explores how advanced data technologies are used in programs associated with poverty. The book includes three case studies involving applications for determining eligibility for benefits and housing and preventing child abuse and neglect. While arguably intended to provide better and more efficient services, these applications are deployed in ways that can support surveillance, profiling, and punishment. Welcome, Virginia. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can we start with that EBT card conversation you mentioned early on that was sort of part of the inspiration for the book?
Sure. So one of the sort of origin stories that I tell about the book happened about 20 years ago. I come from a background in both economic justice and welfare rights organizing, but also in community technology centers. So this sort of movement in the United States in the mid-1990s that was intended to sort of develop technological infrastructure to give poor and working class communities access to the tools of the internet revolution. And one of the places where I did some of this work was a residential YWCA in my hometown of Troy, New York. And one of the women, 90 poor and working class women who lived in the Y, it was sort of like a single room occupancy hotel. And one of the women I worked with to develop this sort of community tech lab that we had at the Y goes by the pseudonym Dorothy Allen in the book. And Dorothy and I were sort of sitting around in the lab one morning, just sort of shooting the breeze. And one of the things I asked her about was her, just about her relationship with technology generally. And one of the things I asked her about specifically was her electronic benefits transfer card, her EBT card, which is the like ATM-like card that you get public benefits on. So she was a young mom on public assistance. And I asked, Dorothy, what do you think about this? I've heard from some people that there's less stigma because you're not pulling, actual paper food stamps out of the grocery store. It's more convenient. What do you think? And she said, it's those things. It's a bit better in terms of convenience than what came before. But also, my caseworker uses it to track all of my food purchases. And because she has access to all the locations where I buy stuff, she can also track all of my movements. And I must have had this really incredibly sort of naively shocked look on my face because she sort of laughed at me for a little while. And then very generously, I think, she said, oh, Virginia, you all, meaning sort of professional middle class people, you all should pay attention to what's happening to us because they're coming for you next. And so that's very much a voice that has always been in the back of my head as I enter into doing the kind of research and writing that I do about technology and economic justice, is Dorothy's voice both reminding me of like how generous folks can be around caring about other people's experiences, even when they're facing, some of the worst, most invasive scrutiny that you can imagine. But also that the for me, the most important place to start these stories of our new sort of high-tech tools, new government high-tech tools, is starting in poor and working class communities, because it's places like the YWCA, it's places like the welfare system or the criminal justice system where we're going to see the issues most clearly, and the stakes are going to be most obvious there. So that was the goal, writing Automating Inequality, was really telling the stories of these new government technologies we have, but telling them from the point of view of poor and working class families who feel like they're the targets of these systems.
Virginia, if I could ask you about one of your blog posts that sort of relates to your discussion of working class families. You take exception with the definitions of class in America, and I found that fascinating.
Well, thank you so much. I mostly take exception with the lack of sort of rigorous language we have for talking about class in the United States. So we don't talk about class very effectively. We tend to pretend we don't have classes in the U.S. And when we, you know, do surveys and things around class, we tend to give people like three options, which is like low, middle, and high. And no one wants to be low class, and no one wants to be high class, so everybody just picks middle. And it actually leaves us without like really good terms and good theories and good ways of describing our own experience. So I do talk specifically about poor people, and I use that intentionally because I believe that poor is a political identity, that anyone who has ever lacked any one of their basic economic human rights, like food, housing, a job with a safe job with a decent wage, medical care, quality education, anyone who's ever lacked any one of those things, I believe can meaningfully include themselves among the political identity of poor. But I also believe that when you give people, I understand that that's a tough call for a lot of folks because we have so much stigma attached to the category of poor. That I'm also really interested in thinking through what it means to be poor and working class. And I often use those things synonymously because many working class people have experienced the lack of access to one of their basic human rights. And when I use poor and working class, I also just want to be really clear that I'm really intentional about talking about class across other kinds of difference, so across gender, across race, across sexuality, like all the way that these things intersect actually really, really matters to how we experience poverty in the United States.
Well, I worked for several years in poverty programs, and I came to understand that there are like societal structures for hiding the most poor and the least advantaged people, that you couldn't see them really, that they were hidden from view. And to the extent that you could see them, there was a tendency to sort of blame them for their situation, like blaming the victim.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Though I think increasingly, like in this decade that we're living in, if you are not currently a poor working class person, to say that like the poor and working class are hidden in America is like a kind of consensual blindness that borders on intentional ignorance. It's really not hard to recognize the economic inequality we're facing in this country right now. So I agree with you that we have built systems, political systems, systems in the media, cultural institutions that are all about helping us ignore economic inequality. But I think that the moment has changed. I think it's really hard to say that there is anything hidden about poverty in the United States right now. I don't think there's an attempt to make people invisible, but it really takes a kind of willful blindness to sort of fall for that now. But one of the things that is important to me about using this this sort of category of poor and working class people is that it allows people to see themselves inside that category. And I'll give you like a very short, concrete example to help it from, to make sure it doesn't get too abstract. So I worked in welfare rights movements for close to 20 years. And part of where this definition of poverty comes from for me is from an amazing national organization called the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. And the welfare rights group that I worked with was a member organization of, it's called PPERC, of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. We were very much interested in doing work that helped people see themselves as having experiences with poverty by this definition. And yet for the entire time I was organizing, I identified personally as someone who cared deeply about poverty, but was had not ever gotten public assistance myself. And then last year I was at this conference where we were talking about sort of media justice. And one of the things that came up was Universal Lifeline, which is, of course, government subsidized access to the tools of communication. Now you would think of it, people refer to it as Obama phones. But, you know, decades ago, it would be access to landline phones. And so I was talking to this person about Universal Lifeline. And I was like, oh, yeah, I was on Universal Lifeline for years. And I had this light bulb moment that, like, after 20 years of being a welfare rights organizer who claimed not to be on welfare, I had, in fact, been on welfare, right? So that's how powerful that narrative is. It's like, literally, that was my work. And I did not see myself in that category of people who access public assistance. And so a lot of the work that I'm most excited about right now politically is doing the work to help people see themselves as having things in common, including their economic struggles.
We've had this kind of social inequality we're discussing. We've had it for a long time, way before we had computers. How much are you focusing on social applications of technology that are new, and how much on the kinds of social inequality that have been part of our experience for, you know, since dirt, really? I mean, all along.
So I use this metaphor in the book of the digital poorhouse. And I use that really intentionally because when we talk about these sort of new high-tech tools, we tend to talk about them as if they sort of arrived from nowhere and landed in, you know, a blank field, like the monolith from 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? It just sort of appears from space and everything evolves. But the tools that I looked at in automating inequality seem to me to be much more evolution than revolution. So I ground the work in this history of how poverty policy in the U.S. has worked historically. And I start that history in the moment of the county poorhouse, which was a brick and mortar institution. They were built in the early 1800s through the early 1900s in the U.S. They were brick and mortar institutions for incarcerating poor and working class people. It was no small thing to be sent to be sent to the poorhouse. If you entered a poorhouse, you lost the right to vote and the right to hold office. You couldn't marry. If you had children, often your children were separated from you and sent to wealthier families as free labor, as apprentice labor, as domestic or agricultural labor. And some of these institutions had death rates as high as 30% annually. So a third of people entering the poorhouse every year died there. So these are pretty horrifying institutions. But the reason I start the history in the actual brick and mortar county poorhouse is because very much that's the moment in U.S. history where we decide that the goal of social assistance should be to make the conditions of receiving public help so horrifying that no one would dare request it unless they were absolutely desperate. So it's this moment where we decide that rather than building universal floors to support all of us, that we're going to build these moral thermometers that decide if you're desperate enough, if you're poor enough, if you're morally worthy enough to receive public support. And I feel like that moment, that idea that public services should be a moral thermometer rather than a universal floor, is part of the sort of deep social programming that underlies all of these new tools that we see in social services.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. When I was working with poverty programs, with benefits specifically, the actual policy for determining eligibility for benefits was pretty objective. I mean, they tried to be really objective about setting, you know, if you are below a particular income limit and you don't have sufficient resources and so forth, then you have eligibility for, say, food stamps or FDC or Medicaid. But there was always, within the actual system itself, within the people who were actually administering the system, there was a sense of a kind of moral judgment going on. And sometimes that led to a kind of sort of police mentality within caseworkers, where they would actually become, they would find themselves becoming investigators of a sort and looking into the possibility of fraud and that sort of thing. The systems that we were working with that were, you know, pen and paper became systems that were computer based. And we had like an automated worksheet for doing the same kind of test, you know, means test that we had done on pen and paper before. But part of this is just in the psychology and not in the technology itself.
Yeah, so that's a really important point. On one side, like to go back to the history briefly, you're speaking about a sort of relationship that has been around for a long time, right? So where we get the language of casework is actually from scientific charity, which came up around the 1890s. And scientific charity originally used police officers to investigate requests for support. And that's why we have the language of cases, right? Like you are investigating a case. Again, there's nothing inevitable or natural about that. That's a choice we made around how to run our public service programs as if they are investigations, our police. And so that's been with us for a long time. And we, this is one of the parts of the history I tell is how the sort of analog versions of caseworkers acting like police became this sort of digital systems, which I call the digital poorhouse. And that actually happened much earlier than I thought it might have. So it happened in the late 60s and early 1970s, where we started moving to digital computers, in part as a response to the very sort of active and successful national welfare rights movement. So the national welfare rights movement was having this incredible successes, legal successes, overturning things like discriminatory eligibility rules that blocked African American families from receiving public assistance well into the late 60s and early 70s. And also the fact that frontline caseworkers were threatening to go on strike, not for their own employment contract, but in order to lower the barriers for families who were applying for public assistance. In 1968, 5,000 caseworkers in New York City went on strike for the clients, not for their own jobs, but for the clients. And that's the moment that we see these new computerized systems start to rise across the country. And I think that's not accidental, right? Just in the way that like the move to predictive analytics today is not accidental in this sort of general atmosphere of contempt for public employees. I think it's really important to understand these things in their historical context. But it's also, you know, not just the same thing playing out over and over again, right? There are things about the move to digital technologies that is quite different and really important. So the digital poorhouse metaphor is a good one, but it only goes so far. There's a lot of things about these tools that are new and that we really should be paying attention to.
Do you think the recent uproar over data analytics, the Cambridge Analytica scandal and similar things that have been in the news will help combat some of this, slavery to the digital analysis of who's poor and who's not.
Yeah, I think we're in what's going to be a really interesting moment around these tools and what the move to these tools means about the health of our democratic institutions, about the way we think about politics, right? I feel like everything we're seeing right now is deeply connected, right? The sort of distrust of politics and sort of the farce of the politics, that the dangerous farce of the politics that we're seeing right now, is very much related to the rise of these tools, and even to the we're seeing a little bit, I think, of a pushback against these tools. I'm hearing a lot in sort of social movement spaces of really creative thinking around, how to navigate these new systems that I'm really excited about. So I think one of the concerns that drove the book, though, is that when we start to talk about our fears and our concerns about these systems, that we have a tendency to only imagine problems and therefore solutions from the point of view of professional middle class people, right? So we have a tendency we'll only talk about, for example, the commercial companies, the Facebooks and the Googles, and that's real, and the Ubers, and that's really important. I'm not saying that it isn't, they are all kinds of interactions with technology that are primarily consumer interactions. So they're interactions that, to a degree, you can choose to have or not have, right? You can argue that it's pretty much impossible to avoid Google at this point. But largely, you can make other choices. You can use something else for search and for email. Like you can use Lyft instead of Uber. You can not be on Facebook. The systems that I write about in Automating Inequality are systems that largely people don't have a truly voluntary choice whether they're going to interact with them or not, right? So if you're asking for help from public assistance, then that is because you're lacking a really basic human need. You're lacking food, you're lacking shelter, you lack support for your family. And granted, you could say, for example, don't get food stamps then. If you don't want to give up this information about your family, if you don't want to open yourself up to this kind of digital surveillance, like don't get food stamps. But that, the brilliant Kiara Bridges points out in her book, The Poverty of Privacy. I can't remember the name of the book. It's a fantastic book. It'll come to me. So Kiara Bridges says basically that ignores the existence of child protective services, right? So if you don't have enough money for sufficient healthy food for your family, you can not apply for food stamps, but if you don't have enough food, that actually opens you up to investigation. It's classic neglect. So you open yourself up for investigation by Child Protective Services, which ends up pulling you into the system you just tried to avoid by not applying for food stamps, right? So it's really hard to say that these giving up your information to these programs is truly voluntary. And it was really important to me to be looking at these places in the debate where it's not as easy as like, oh, well, if you want to protect your privacy, just don't use a cell phone, like don't use Facebook. I think the questions are much deeper and they deserve much more serious consideration than that.
Well, and really in these systems, we have the same issues that we have more broadly as a society, the whole question of all the data that's being gathered and the extent to which there's surveillance and who is surveilling whom and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I don't think that these problems were invented with digital technology, but I do think they are taking very different shapes now that we've moved to these digital tools.
Well, a website may have a privacy policy, but does a government institution, that is doing like benefits determination or child protective services or whatever, do they have a privacy policy? And should they?
Yeah, so in most cases, when you're applying for some kind of public assistance, and Child Protective Services is slightly different because you don't apply for Child Protective Services, you're reported to Child Protective Services, and then they choose to investigate you or not. So you don't really have the same kind of relationship to it's like saying, it's like a police investigation. Like, you can't claim privacy in a police investigation. There are rules that protect how folks are able to collect information about you, but you can't sort of claim privacy in that case. But in public assistance, in food stamps or homeless services, there are absolutely, informed consent processes in many of these agencies. The reality, though, is that your consent tends to be fully unconditional, right? Like, you either consent to folks collecting whatever information they want about you and your family, or you don't get benefits, right? And so it's a situation where it's hard to say that consent is truly voluntary. It feels, I think, to many people, very coercive, like you have to trade one of your basic human rights to sort of privacy, to safety, to family integrity, for another one of your human rights, like food or shelter or cash assistance.
One system that comes to mind that I've had dealings with over the years are the credit bureaus, the credit reporting systems, and they, I'm sure, impact just about anyone in the country, and there's not a lot of consent. If you live and spend money or have a job or do anything, you end up in a credit bureau report.
Sure. I would point out, though, that there didn't used to be any kind of way to check why you got the credit score you got, right? So until there was a social movement of people who were like, hey, these largely invisible, they weren't quite algorithms, but they were, statistical decisions are undemocratic and unjust. They're not transparent. We don't know what's in them. And we, as a people, demand to know how the inside of these systems work so we can correct our credit score if it's wrong, so we can help you make better decisions. And so we can, have some kind of power in relationship to these systems. And we have things like, ways that you can check your own credit score now because we demanded it. And I think it's actually a really good model for the moment we have right now, that we should also be demanding to have the same kind of access to the inside of these predictive analytics and automated decision-making systems that I looked at in places like Indiana and Los Angeles and Allegheny County.
One problem with algorithms, though, is that they could show you the algorithm and you wouldn't necessarily comprehend it unless you had some level of technical expertise.
Yeah, I think we say that. I'm not sure that that's entirely true. So I will say I'm not a data scientist. And many of the systems that I write about in the book are often reported as being much more complicated than they actually are. And there is a kind of math washing that goes into the press for these tools. I don't think that normal people like me and other folks are by any stretch of the imagination, incapable of understanding how these tools work. And I actually don't think understanding how the tools work is as important as understanding the impacts they're having on our communities. And that's something that we're all experts in. We're all experts in our own lives. So I believe you should understand a bit about how these tools work. But I also don't think that we all have to rush out and get computer science degrees in order to make decisions collectively about how we want our democracy to work, we want public agencies to work.
Doug Rushkoff says, he has a book called this, Program or Be Programmed. And his argument is that people really should work in however way makes sense to them to get a better comprehension of technology and to learn something about how code is developed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea. Sure. But I also say that I also think it's really important to understand that the people who are on the who are the targets of these systems, my experience as a reporter on this work is that they understand how these systems work perfectly well. They may not have, you know, the exact right language to explain everything in the proper technical terms all the time, but they certainly understand how they're affecting their families and their communities. And I think that demanding that everyone, you know, get some basic data science 101 education before you're allowed to contribute to this conversation is profoundly undemocratic, because what it does is cut out of the conversation the people who are in fact most impacted by these systems. And we don't just need to understand how technology works in order to have something to say about these tools. These tools are making political decisions for us right now. They are stand-ins for policies, and we are perfectly equipped to make decisions about what kind of values we want our public agencies to have at their heart as they run. While I don't disagree that this is a basic kind of literacy that is important to just life right now, I also don't think it is the only kind of literacy that is important to life right now. You also have to understand something about how American inequality works, and you have to understand something about the stories we tell about poverty in order to really understand this work. And we rarely require that the folks on the data science side, the folks on the predictive analytics side, have any real grounding in politics, for example. And that's equally as important to understanding code.
Absolutely. I've always thought it was important for people who were basically geeks to work on their political consciousness and to have a better sense of, among other things, the implications of the work that they do.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. I think it's crucial for folks also to understand, right, there's this kind of philosophy that I found across the cases that I reported in the book, which was this idea that politics can be understood as a kind of systems engineering, and that the main sort of contribution that data science could make is making sure that the right information gets to the right decision makers. But the assumption was then once the best information gets to the people who have the power to make decisions, that will naturally result in, you know, equitable, fair, rational decisions. And I mean, for better or worse, that's just not how politics works. And so I spoke to a lot of people who are very smart about data and very smart about information systems, but maybe a little naive about politics. And so things that really surprised or shocked them about the uses to which they're often fine, smart, and well-intentioned work got put, those things were often not surprises to me or surprises to the people who are targets of these systems. They were just surprises to the folks who designed the systems, who couldn't imagine that someone would use one of these tools against their original, like, you know, sort of rational intent. I'll get, you know, the best example of that would be like the DACA database, right? The Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals database. So under an Obama administration, the federal government convinced 800,000 undocumented folks who had been brought to this, who were brought to this country before they were 18, to give their information to the government in order to defer their deportation if the DREAM Act passed. Now those 800,000 people sitting in this database are now incredibly vulnerable under a changed leadership, under a regime change, to that tool actually turning into a list for deportation rather than a way to protect folks from deportation. And so if we don't build our sort of most deeply held values into these tools, if we don't make them unhackable in terms of their values, then we should not be surprised when these tools are used against our best intentions. And I really do think most of the folks I talked to for the book had really, really, most of the designers had really, really good intentions, really cared about the people, the agencies they were involved with served, and were very, very smart people. But we're not currently building tools that align with our values beyond sort of the basest ones, things like efficiency and cost savings. And we need to, we can do better than that. We're basically, we're building systems that don't have the kind of gears they need to really ride through the hills and valleys of inequality that actually exist in this country. And if we continue to build systems in neutral, we should not be surprised when they, rather than solving bias problems, they amplify or intensify inequality.
Yeah, that sort of gets to what my final question was going to be, which is whether you see ways that we can design technologies that are fair to the poor and lay the groundwork for systems that are not only fair, but truly helpful.
Yeah, so I think that's absolutely possible. I think that too often we believe that equity will take care of itself, or we believe that designing tools that are objective and neutral will create equity. That's not true, clearly. And we actually need to build our tools with some very basic values like dignity and self-determination first. So I, in the book, I talk about sort of two kind of gut level check questions that designers should be asking themselves about how their tools will be used. One is, will your tool increase the self-determination and dignity of poor and working people? The second is, if the tool was designed for any other group of people rather than poor and working class folks, would it be tolerated? And if you can't answer yes to both of those, then I think you're on the wrong side of history. But I think the work that has to be done is so much bigger than these technological tweaks. So I think we need to be telling really different stories about poverty in the United States. We need to be sharing more of the truth of our experience with economic inequality. We need to start shifting our politics away from these moral thermometers that I talked about earlier and towards universal floors, non-means tested programs that are based in people's economic human rights rather than this idea of judging whether someone is deserving or undeserving of their fair share of our collective resources. And in the meantime, you know, technology won't just stop while we work through these really deep seated issues in the US. So we have to be, we have to also be designing tools that do less harm. And so I think it's big work. I think it's work that has to happen on multiple levels at the same time. It has to be cultural, it has to be political, it has to be technological all at the same time. So I think it's a big challenge. But I also think that the building these tools badly is only cheap in the short run. In the long run, it costs us more money, more time, and is much more demeaning of our humanity to build these tools badly. And I think all of the cases in automating inequality show the real hazards of that path.
Virginia's book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor, is available through online booksellers or at many local bookstores. Learn more about Virginia at virginia-eubanks.com. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney, and this is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.